possible. When he finished pulling up the rope, Talmadge turned to find Coté sitting on a stone, chewing on a long blade of grass, and staring at him, with a sly little grin.
"What?"
he asked.
"You've not the heart to kill them."
Again he merely shrugged.
"You understand that's why I have fallen in love with you, yes?"
Coté said. Talmadge almost pitched off the cliff. Had a breeze come up, he was certain he would have been blown into the gully. Coté laughed at him, and spun off the rock, twirling gracefully to her feet on the other side, and started away to the west.
"Come along," she said. "Maybe I'll even teach you how to fight."
Talmadge started to protest, but bit it back and let it go at that, and he was smiling too widely to even care. Somehow, and suddenly, his journey this season seemed much less daunting. 15. His. Aulën opened her sleepy eyes to discover, to her surprise, that she was back in her cot in Shona's tent. The light streamed in on her face through the open flap, and she lifted her arm to cover her eyes. The night had passed, at least. Her stomach rumbled, reminding her that she'd barely eaten. "Half-cooked meat," she muttered, trying to recall the events of that night, most of which were missing. She rose shakily to her feet. Her head throbbed. She brought her hand to her temple, remembering, barely, the cut of the flint knife. There was no blood there, nor could she feel a scab. Had it been a dream, after all? She moved to the wash basin to check her reflection in its still, reflective surface. Not a mark showed on her smooth skin. She splashed some water on her face. "Was I dreaming?" she wondered aloud.
"Hardly,"
Shona said. Aulën jumped at the sound and whirled about.
"It was not a dream,"
Shona calmly assured her, when both steadied from Aulën's leaping response.
"It was a ritual, one that all Uskar girls, young women, attend."
"What ritual?"
Aulën said, a voice thick with suspicion, and not a small amount of dread.
"What did it mean? What was all the smoke for?"
The memories began flooding back to her, inciting more questions. The evening came again into perspective, but she could hardly make sense of what had happened. One moment stood out from the others, though. One mystery she needed to unravel.
"The markings on his chest. Where did he get them?"
she asked, remembering the mesmerizing play of the light across the dark, inky lines. Shona snorted, but managed to stifle a louder and longer laugh. And only with great difficulty, Aulën noted.
"He got the markings from us," she said. "Why, of course, they are called spatrings, or tattoos. Many men are so painted, with many designs."
Aulën's eyes lit up.
"We women do it. Will I learn to do that? Will I be able to make such marks?"
Shona nodded and shrugged at the same time.
"Perhaps," she said, noncommittally. "It is one of the duties of the witches of the coven. In time, if you are selected for that honor, you will learn that talent, yes. But it is a sacred and secret ritual, intimately tied to the magic wielded only by the coven."
"You used magic last night,"
Aulën pointed out, rather harshly. Shona seemed somewhat confused.
"You are not of the coven,"
Aulën explained. Danger flashed across Shona's eyes, and Aulën retreated a step.
"Once a witch is ever a witch,"
she said, as the moment passed.
"I could not unlearn the beauty of Uskar. No one could. Once you have seen truth, child, you will never forget."
Aulën's black eyes flashed too, but with hunger.
"If you are selected, you will understand," Shona said. "You will not learn the sacred rituals until you are inducted into the coven properly, as a woman." Alan was nodding before Shona finished the thought. She could be patient. She pictured herself, a grown woman, covered in beautiful, mesmerizing tattoos, dancing in the firelight with the other women of the tribe.
"Wait," she said, a bit perplexed. "I've seen the women dance before, at the festivals and blessings. I've seen them barely dressed. I've seen you undressed. But no one has any of these markings."
"Of course you haven't, child. Tattoos are for the men."
"But,"
she could hardly find the words to express her disappointment,
"they are so beautiful.
If the coven can make them, surely the witches could mark themselves." Shona's demeanor suddenly grew quite stern.
"Aye," she said, "we could, but we will not. Tattoos are for the men, not for the women. They are a mark of status among the warriors of the tribe. They are earned, not given. Most in battle, or in the success of a hunt. You should be glad that your man at the fire last night had so many. It means he is an accomplished warrior, and well regarded."
"Breath?" Aulan asked. "Who is he to me?
Why should I—"
"You're intended," Shona interrupted.
"Intended?" she asked, perplexed. "What does that mean?"
"It means, once you're formally declared a woman, you will be his. His woman. His wife. And most of all, his problem, and no longer mine."
Shona sounded gruff and angry, like Aulan had done something wrong, had gotten into trouble yet again.
"His wife? Who is he? Why should I want to be his wife?" Aulan asked.
Shona scoffed at her.
"Want? What you want does not matter, foolish girl. The tribal leaders have decided that you shall belong to that man, and it shall be so."
"When?"
she whispered.
"As soon as you are a woman."
Aulan stared at her, not hiding her confusion.
"Yes, I know you have bled," Shona said. "You are his now, and can be claimed by no others unless he dies. You will be wed to him as early as this coming winter solstice, though it's more likely that you'll have to wait some few years before assuming your duties to him, that you can be properly taught in the ways of the crystals and Uskar, if you show that you are worthy of the training."
She said it like a threat, like her words were tying an inescapable noose around Aulan's neck. Shona already had all the power over her, and now she had just strengthened that position. That pit in Aulan's chest returned, filling her with hurt and anger. Again, she could not pinpoint the precise reason, but it was something about the way Shona had said, "his." She would be his woman. His wife, his property, like the Umas, like Badlan's mother. Aulan stumbled toward the exit. She mumbled something about being hungry, needing food, but in truth she doubted she could eat right then. She simply needed some air, to be somewhere else, away from Shona and all this disturbing talk. She broke into a run as soon as she cleared the doorway. She didn't have a destination in mind, she merely wanted to be not here. But her feet carried her somewhere unexpected, and she didn't realize she was heading there until she arrived. Outside the grove of thick pines that housed the slaves, Badlan sat on the ground, playing with a stick.
"You will come with me,"
she commanded. Badlan jumped up at the sudden sound of her voice, leaping about to look at her. He appeared wholly confused. But this time he didn't hesitate for long. He gazed at the ground as he walked, but he rushed to follow her without complaint. Aulan led the boy a short way from the slave grove. She was feeling defiant, feeling like she had to strike back against the terrible reality that seemed to be closing in all around her. Shona's warning followed her, though, and so she certainly didn't want to get into too much trouble right now. And so she decided against heading for the woods. Instead, she found a little nook on the cliff face, took a seat, and beckoned Badlan to do the same. The boy obeyed without complaint.
"Your mother isn't from the mountain," she stated.
Badlan grunted, indicating that he understood.
Is she from the Lake Towns?
Owlin pressed him.
The boy grunted again, this time a non-committal sound that seemed to Owlin to mean, I don't know.
Owlin nodded and answered her own question.
She is. She's from one of the Lake Towns.
I knew it. I remember the raid when the warriors took her and brought her here.
Adlan averted his gaze, and Owlin got the distinct impression he was hiding something.
That's why her head is so long,
Owlin pressed. Adlan inhaled deeply, clearly disturbed.
Has she told you anything about that place?
She asked.
The boy ignored her.
She repeated her question, but he still did not respond, and Owlin, who thought this terribly important, felt her frustration growing.
No, you cannot pretend,
she said with a growl.
Listen to me. I know you understand my words, even if you pretend not to speak. You take commands. You know what the words mean. I know your mother speaks to you of the Lake Towns, so you know about them.
Adlan looked up. His eyes were wide, his face ashen. He seemed terrified. He did not grunt or nod, but Owlin knew she had sorted it out.
Now listen, she said, softening her voice, trying to sound non-threatening. I don't care that you know about them. I don't care that you cannot speak or choose to say nothing, or whatever it is that makes you grunt all the time. I'm not trying to trick you, or catch you doing something wrong or anything like that.
The boy looked doubtful, and he seemed very small to Owlin in that moment. She reminded herself that he was really a child, not like her. He was nearing 14, but was much simpler than that. More like a boy of 10, it seemed to Owlin.
Besides, she said, if I wanted to get you in trouble, I could just tell the warriors whatever I wanted. Those fools would believe me over anything you might or might not say.
Owlin was trying to make it light-hearted, a tease, but as she heard her own words, she realized that what she was saying here was clearly a threat, and one that no slave would take lightly. Truly, the boy looked petrified. He started to rise, though his legs seemed as if they hadn't the strength to support him. But before he got up, as if he remembered that he had been commanded to sit, he let go and plopped back down, looking miserable and afraid. Owlin glanced all around and patted her hands in the air. She moved very close to Badlan, that he could look into her black eyes. I'm not trying to get you into trouble, she said quietly. Not at all. I just want to know some things.
She kept her voice soft, and was surprised by how much she cared about making this pitiful little slave boy so uneasy. She thought back to that long-ago day when she had defended him against two boys of her own tribe.
Adlan seemed like he needed that same kind of protection right now. I'll ask questions, and you just nod yes or shake your head no. All right.
The boy did not move a muscle. Owlin rolled her eyes at him.
That was a question, Badlan, she said sarcastically.
The boy looked confused for a moment, then nodded somewhat emphatically.
Your mother, she said. She came from one of the villages on the lake?
Badlan nodded.
There are many villages there?
The boy nodded again, glanced around and held up all the fingers on one hand and two on the other. Owlin was surprised at how quickly Badlan volunteered that information, and was surprised indeed that this supposedly feeble-minded boy could even count to seven.
Is it true that the lake is the end of the world? No one lives past it, she asked.
She already knew the answer. Despite the tribe's legends, the mountain and the lake were not the only inhabited lands around. She was more curious whether Badlan knew that than anything. Badlan nodded emphatically. He opened his mouth as if to speak, but no words came forth. Owlin wasn't sure if he was considering what to say, or struggling to say anything at all. In either case, he closed his mouth again and kept nodding. Owlin didn't believe him. There were people beyond the lake, and Badlan knew it.
Alan pondered where she wanted this conversation to go. She needed to know something, but she wasn't sure what to ask. Asking about the wider world would be useless. The child probably knew very little of the world beyond the mountain and the lake, and what he did know would be nothing more than stories his mother had whispered into his ear. The young woman had to remind herself that this boy, who was not Uskar, was even less worldly than she. In her desperation, though, she had to believe that he knew something, but of course he had no way to communicate that little information without her directly asking, and she had no idea what to even ask. But Alan's troubles were closer to home, anyway. She felt that pit in her chest again, that painful lump of emptiness and rage.
"In the lake village, did your mother have a husband?" Alan asked.
Adlan looked at her curiously.
"Your father?" she asked.
Adlan nodded again and grunted a little.
"Where is he? Still in the village?"
Adlan cast his gaze down and shook his head, and Alan got the message. She had suspected as much. When Te Orlig had become Uskar Lauch, the tribe had held a great celebration to recount his greatest victories. One of those spoken of was the raid that had captured the pregnant woman. In verse and in toast, the tribe had celebrated that victory. No Uskar warriors had been slain in that raid, but some of the lakemen had. Alan gave him a sympathetic look. Her own father was dead as well. Perhaps from a raid battle. Perhaps from a hunt. Perhaps from the winter wind. No one would tell her about him or the circumstances. Her mother, too, was gone, soon after her birth, or perhaps during it. Again, none would recount the details to her. Perhaps because of that, Aulan suddenly wanted to know more from Badlan.
"Your father," she asked, "did he own your mother?"
Badlan's face screwed up in apparent horror.
"Was your mother his to command?" Aulan pressed. "Was she his umas, his slave?"
The Uskar had an expression, nyonachard, which they used to mock someone who seemed truly dumbfounded by an insult or an accusation. Not until this moment, with the purely nonplussed expression on Badlan's face, did Aulan begin to comprehend the depth of that remark. Badlan's jaw was still hanging open when he had recovered enough to shake his head even more emphatically, as if the entire notion was absurd and revolting. Alan was aware of the disdain the warriors held for the men who lived by the lake. Was this, perhaps, one of the differences that drew such sneers?
"Your mother speaks to you about him," Alan reasoned.
Badlan didn't answer. But Alan didn't need him to answer. He looked down at the ground.
"Fondly?"
Adlan glanced up again, and Alan caught the sparkle in his blue eyes, and she understood, for she recognized that look in her own eyes. Feeling the magic of Uskar had given her that inner sparkle. Alan had felt the same as she saw in Badlan now, the rush of a rapid heartbeat, the lightheadedness that followed. She had felt it that night in the tree near the great crystal protrusion in the sacred grove. She had felt it on the winter plateau. She knew how wonderful that feeling was. Badlan felt it when thinking of his father, and he could only know his father through the words of his mother. The weight lifted from Aulan's chest, as if the dark pit beside her line of life energy was filling, buoying her. That was what she had needed to hear. Some confirmation that her mounting revulsion, as Shona had told her of the world she would soon know, was not her perspective alone. From the reaction of Badlan, from that look in his eye, Aulan got the distinct feeling that things were very different in the lake villages below Firoxbuer. Aulan and Badlan sat in their little nook for a long while. Aulan talking, Badlan nodding or grunting or miming. It was nearly sunset when Aulan left Badlan in the pine grove and returned to the encampment. Over the coming days, she would gather the boy and retreat to this sheltered spot whenever she could, for the pit in Owlin's chest always felt less substantial after those conversations with the little slave boy, who was not feeble-minded, as he pretended and as the others believed. From behind a rock not far away, Ogmore watched the young woman and the slave boy leave the sheltered nook. They weren't carrying anything, he noted. So why might they have been out here? Had the child tried to escape, and this woman, Owlin by name, given chase and captured? Ogmore knew quite a bit about Owlin, and her spirited and headstrong reputation, to believe that a possibility. He smiled as he watched her walking back toward the encampment, admiring the play of her muscles in her short and curvy figure. She wasn't the prettiest woman in the tribe, certainly was neither tall nor fair. Still, his best friend Breyth was a fortunate one, Ogmore thought, for the fire of Owlin was hard to deny. Or perhaps Breyth would be monumentally unlucky, Ogmore considered, and his smile grew wider. He loved Breyth like a brother, even though Breyth had nearly killed him on that raid those years before. Still, the young man couldn't help but grin at the trouble he pictured this young Owlin would give to his friend. Her spirit was the stuff of legend among the young warriors. It was said that the only time she cast her eyes down was to find a stone to throw into someone's face. Breyth was in for a wild ride indeed. Ogmore stopped nodding, and his smile disappeared a moment later when Owlin returned to say something to the young slave. They were holding hands. And the boy looked back at her, and grinned, and nodded. 16. Confession. The deciduous trees swayed in a mesmerizing, multicolored dance, the autumn wind of late parvespers blowing strong across Lochbeog. Borne by those gusts, small waves accompanied Talmadge's canoe to the lake shore, beaching in the pebbly shallows right at the water's edge. Chote hopped out and grabbed the front of the boat, dragging it up securely onto the land, before Talmadge had even secured his paddle. "Karach Sailach?" the woman asked when he joined her on the beach. "Another day's journey yet. We could get more hours this day. The sun has not touched the western rim." Talmadge tried to verbally respond, but only sighed and shook his head. He had known that he would have to return to this ghost-filled spot from the moment he had agreed to let Chote accompany him to Lochbeog.
"We go the rest of the way on foot, then?"
Chote asked.
"We'll be back on the waters at sunrise," Talmadge explained. "You'll meet the tribe before tomorrow's twilight."
Chote shrugged curiously.
"Why here, then? Why this place?"
Talmadge didn't answer.
"Is there something here?"
Talmadge nodded.
"Supplies? A safe haven for the night?
Do you fear those three rogues are following us?
I've seen no sign of them since we left them more than a month ago.
This is the least safe place I know," he admitted, though he was thinking more of his emotions than his physical well-being.
"Then why?"
Talmadge looked back to the boat, then closed his eyes, trying to find the courage to continue.
"You have to do this," he told himself under his breath.
"Talmadge?" she asked, her voice changing in timbre, becoming sympathetic, concerned even. "Talmadge, why have you stopped here?"
There was also a bit of trepidation in her voice, Talmadge realized, and he noted concern on her face, and that she had shifted one leg back defensively. Only then did he realize that he had reflexively put his hand on the hilt of his short sword. He let go of the weapon immediately.
"I've been here but once," he explained. "Since that time, I paddle farther out into the lake to loop about far from this place, though 'tis more dangerous out on the deeper stretches by far."
"When was that one time?"
13 years ago.
Chote nodded and narrowed her eyes, as if trying to do some calculations to sort this riddle.
Talmud turned away, motioned for her to follow, and determinedly put one foot in front of the other, propelling him toward a nearby stand of trees, and one in particular. He stopped before the thick branch, crossing horizontally some 8 feet from the ground, and he licked his lips, trying to steady himself, when he discovered a rope still tied about a low and thick branch. Over the years, that thick cord had dug deeply into the wood, and seemed somehow a permanent fixture of this place now. It was knotted underneath, with a short and frayed length hanging down a foot or so. Talmadge remembered tying that knot.
13 years ago,
he heard Chote say behind him.
Would that be the last time you brought one with you here? The year the man named...
Her face screwed up as she tried to remember. Talmadge fought the words, but only for a moment, before blurting, "Sokonk," he answered. "They called him Badger. I hung him up by the ankles right there. With that rope. So the lizards would eat him, and not chase me back onto the lake waters." There came no reply.
"I heard them eating him," he said, pushing as hard as he could. "I heard the flesh ripping and the crunching bones.
And the screams?"
"He was already dead,"
Talmadge replied. He didn't turn about to face the woman, and could well imagine her standing behind him with her whip and dagger drawn, ready to stab him in the back.
"He died fighting the lizards?"
she asked, and when he didn't immediately answer, she added, "No dishonor in using a dead man to shield a retreat. The dead are dead. We bury them when we can, but when we cannot..."
"I killed him,"
Talmadge growled, spinning about. Chote jumped just a bit, startled, but relaxed quickly and made no move and showed no reaction. Nor was she holding her weapons, Talmadge noted.
"I put my sword, this sword, into his chest," he confessed. "Slid it right to the hilt. I smelled his blood and his last breath. I felt the warmth of that blood spilling over my hand."
"You do not sound as if you much enjoyed it."
"I hated it," he said through his gritted teeth. And truly Talmadge wanted to scream out then, or fall down crying. "You think I wanted to kill him?"
"Then why?"
"Because he tried to kill me. And before that, he would have let me die. He hoped I'd die so that he could take my share of the goods and trade them with the villagers of Karsailach."
Chote appeared confused. How could she not?
So Talmadge told her of the events of that long-ago day, of the giant Cloderch lizards fleeing the water, of Badger's shove when he had gotten out of the canoe, and the man's run to the tree. Of the taunting by Badger during Talmadge's fight with the giant lizard. Then the prompting by Talmadge to get Badger to reveal the depths of his treachery as the pair headed for their craft.
"He stabbed for my back, but I was ready for it, and I knocked his blade aside and put my sword into the opening,"
Talmadge finished. Chote nodded, and seemed somewhat impressed.
"And you hung him here for the other lizards," she said, putting it all together. She smiled as she finished, and moved to a spot just below and to the side of the rope, where she fell to her knees and began scraping at the dirt and brush.
A moment later, Chote held up her prize, a sizable portion of a human skull, upper jaw and teeth still intact. Talmadge recoiled. But Chote was smiling knowingly.
"Is that the only time you've killed a man, then?" she asked.
He didn't answer, but his expression and the sheer level of discomfort here made it quite clear that this incident was indeed unique.
"He would have killed you?"
"Yes," Talmadge had to force the word from his throat. Chote nodded, her smile remaining.
"In the time it took you to hang him up for the beasts, you could have gone to your boat and paddled far away,"
she reasoned.
"No. The lake monster was out there. It had driven the lizards from the water, and schools of fish, too. I needed to stay on the land for a..."
His voice trailed off as he came to realize how incredibly feeble his story sounded. He could have simply gone up the same tree Badger had climbed.
Because you were mad at him for trying to kill you, Cote said. Outraged. Killing him wasn't enough for you.
No, you had to insult his corpse, to let the lizards eat him, as he had hoped they would do to you.
Talmadge had no answers.
Admit it, she said,
but quickly added,
to yourself, you'll feel all the better.
Talmadge stared at her curiously.
Which bothers you more? She asked.
He shrugged.
Killing the fool, or hanging him for the lizards?
Talmadge swallowed hard.
All of it.
Crochet gave a little chuckle, one that showed both sympathy and amusement.
Now I'm getting why you demanded we let those three criminals go free back at the river, she said. It'd have been smart to kill them, and we had every right. But Talmadge couldn't travel that dark road of killing again, could he? Because the ghost of Badger's been chasing him for most of his life.
He didn't deny a word of it, nor did he try to argue about his decision regarding the three people he had saved from that goblin attack.
We all write the stories of our life, Talmadge said, echoing the philosophy Chote had explained to him many times before. In Chote's Togairu world, the journey of one's life was considered a story unfolding, written by the subject with her actions. It was a way of looking at life that Talmadge considered both liberating and selfish, but the more the man had become familiar with Chote and her ways, the more he had come to recognize the limited avenues of his life, and the more the philosophy had won him over.
We do, Chote answered. Ours, each, is the tale of a life. One life. Travelling roads and bouncing into others. But in the end, it is a solitary journey. A tale of one woman or one man.
In my story, it will be written that I killed a man, Talmadge said. That is not a tale I wished to write.
Few would wish to write that tale, Chote replied. Yet many do. Too many. Especially out here.
Has Chote written such a tale? He asked.
The woman didn't answer, other than to return a dubious stare, as if she couldn't even believe he would ask the question, or, more pointedly, that he believed he had to ask the question.
Many such tales, Talmadge asked.
My story is wide and thick,
was all she'd say, and Talmadge understood her to mean thick with both lovers and enemies. Dead enemies. The roads of a life story, as defined by Chote's way of looking at the world, were usually more about people one bounced against than the physical roads one travelled.
Well, now you know that mine is perhaps thicker than you had believed, Talmadge offered.
Chote shrugged and returned a warm smile.
The fool tried to murder you, and you were the stronger, she said in unvarnished tones. His death is his own doing. And better that outcome than further. No matter your choice, then, he'd have been eaten by the lizards whether you'd strung him or left him, or eaten by worms and beetles if you'd buried him, or by fish if you'd dragged him into the lake.
Thank you, the man said, straight from his gut and before he could even consider his response.
I cannot know what is in your heart, Chote told him. Not really. No one can know that of another. But we watch and hear and listen to each other and to common friends. And we make a guess. Long ago, I guessed that Talmadge was a good man. A man of honor. I'm not surprised that this journey with Badger, all of this burdened you, sir. And for all these long years...
She paused and dropped the skull, and then swept her hand and... gazed up toward the tree limb and the rope that had grown to be a part of it.
Your pain at telling me the tale only proves my guess.
The man felt better.
Felt as if a great weight had, at long last, been lifted from his shoulders. For most of his adult life, the incident here with Badger had haunted him. How he had wanted to take Chote here before. to show her the way of the lake tribes and the sheer beauty of Loch Piag and the majesty of the snow-haired mountains.
The Sur Cruag Mornat.
He looked down at the skull on the ground, then picked it up and held it aloft between himself and Chote.
"Well, Mr. Sekonk, you entered my tale of your own accord," he said, "and you left my tale of your own actions." He shrugged and tossed the skull, and motioned to the boat, for he had no more reason to be at this place. More importantly, though, Talmadge had no more reason to avoid this place.
Part 3. Writing Their Stories.
I am often amazed at how a simple difference in the way one looks at the world can transform one's actions so profoundly, as obviously as the turn of a prism can change the color of the world seen through it. What may seem a play on words can change the colors of the world around you. Many of the tribes I have encountered name their members after the actions or duties or even a particular aspect of an individual. A hunter may be named Uchorsle because he can throw a spear with great accuracy, and so his talents become his moniker. Similarly, the tribes often name and number their gods in the real animals about them, or in storms they will have to know and learn in order to survive. There are gods of thunder and wind, and great deity beasts to represent the bears or hunting cats. The simple association of language with action, of deifying the great natural events and animals, ties these people more closely with the world around them. Every word becomes a reminder of responsibility or threat, and as such, they've turned their very language into an archive, transferring information one might find in a library at a monastery in Hons. It is brilliant in its simplicity, and a fair warning to those of us more civilized folk that too often overthink and unnecessarily complicate that which should be obvious. The answers to puzzles are, quite often, right there before us. The obvious is sometimes the truth. I am reminded of Marcalo de Onero, once my mentor, though, more truthfully, my tormentor. He led me down a myriad of tangled webs of justification, each walking me further from the simple truth of the immorality of my actions. So easy it is to justify selfishness and pride and all the deadly sins to one who would be so cool. De Onero viewed the world through a turned prism. He had so convinced himself of his elevated, godly duty to protect the ignorant peasants from the truth of their destiny that he could justify any action, murder, torture, war itself, under the guise of service to a higher purpose. So many turn their prisms away from obvious morality, it seems, whether the thief in the streets of Palmares, the murderer in the wilder lands, the too proud king, or the tyrant Father Abbot, so sure of the word of God that all must be sacrificed in service to that inaudible voice and invisible hand. This is how we write our stories, and is that not our life journey, to write our personal stories? A woman named Chote told me that, though it is a simple way of looking at the journey of a life that should have been obvious to me, to us all, and yet, it was not. Not to me, at the very least. Not until I encountered this exotic person, a rare combination of Togai Ru and Alpinadoran heritage, raised in the steppes of Togai, yet wandering beyond the wilder lands themselves, or even the avenues of Hans the Bear's great cities. Chote views her life as a tale to be created, to be written, by her every step and choice. She is an actor in her own play, as are we all. If she finds her play becoming dull, she will seek a new road, a new conflict, a new challenge. Something, anything, to write a page that engages the protagonist, the prime actor, in this journey, herself. She is not restless, but rather engaged.
She is not reckless, but neither timid.
This is her story, her journey, her life. A wasted step is one less step to spend.
Thus has Cote turned her prism, and thus does she turn her prism, never allowing for a static, dull view. It is a trick of semantics, perhaps, or a most simplistic reminder of a philosophical desire to die without regret of those roads untraveled or those mountains unclimbed. Either way, Cote's way of viewing the world and her walk is a continual prod and an unceasing whisper that we, this part of our journey at least, are finite, with end. So we all write our stories. Some end too soon, like the child who dies of plague before learning to even speak, or the mother who, upon finding a new and exciting road to travel, dies in childbirth before the first steps of that are even recorded. Some stories are quite long, a century even, and many centuries for the Tuel Alfar and Doc Alfar, but walk a small circuit so often that the tracks are dug into the paths. The words repeat, repeat, repeat. And so the long story itself becomes nothing more than illusion. You can repeat a sentence 100 times, but it is still just one sentence. To Cote, this would be the same tale as written by one who died a child. It is so simple, so obvious. How I thank Cote for showing it to me. Adrian Winden, In My Travels. 17. Affinity. The last day of the 9th month, Par Vespers, God's year, 854. Shona squared her shoulders, clenched her fists at her sides, and declared again, this time through gritted teeth, "Olan is not ready." It was her third denial, and her most forceful retort, and she sucked in her breath as the powerful man towering over her scowled.
"It does not matter if she is ready or not," Tealeg said, with a level of calmness that hinted of murder. "She is a woman, no longer a girl, and so she must now learn her place and accept it."
He seemed as if he were about to continue. No surprise to Shona, for a long rant from the ever more forceful Te Aleg was easily set into motion. This one was overly proud and surely did not like to be contradicted, and particularly not by a mere woman. Indeed, she saw that flash in his eyes, a promise of a continuing spew of threats and anger. But an upraised hand, just to the side, stopped him short.
"Cert," said an old and shaky voice, but one that carried great weight among the Uskar. For it was that of Raybert, the tribe's Uskar Forfach, the appointed caretaker of the sacred Winter Plateau and the crystal caverns beneath Kreas Adiath. Raybert had earned his current position honestly, for he had been, as Teolig was now, the Uskar Lauch in his youth. Then, as Teolig hoped for himself, Raybert had become the Uskar Triath, the chieftain, and his word had held as final arbiter on every issue for more than a decade before he had been bested in formal challenge by a giant of a man named Thorburn. That had all occurred decades before, and Thorburn was now long dead. And so respected had Raybert been that whispers had lingered for years, even to this day, of reinstating him as Uskar Triath. For no other had the accomplishments and respect to assume such a title. But Raybert was in his 9th decade of life, too frail to take on such all-encompassing duties. While most of the tribe thought him half-mad, the rest of the tribe thought him entirely so. Despite that, or because of it, the Uskar looked up to him with reverence, as if the crystalline god spoke through Raybert in every pronouncement. On those rare occasions when Raybert spoke, everyone listened.
Even Te Olig.
And if the old man's words sounded as gibberish, as was often the case, the Uskar looked past that and sought deeper meaning.
Raybert shakily rose to his feet. The light of the fire in the pre-dawn cast eerie shadows on his face, accentuating the deep lines of age and the deeper scars left from a combative youth. His raids and hunts were still in the songs of the Uskar Skalds. He spoke slowly, heavily.
"The witch speaks truly," he began. "This girl, Olin, is not ready. But are women ever ready?"
He gave a raspy laugh, permission for the other men to join in, and so they did, aiming their mocking tone squarely at Shona. Raybert held up a gnarled hand for silence and stared hard at Shona.
"This young Olin has been properly claimed," he said,
and laughed again, and there was something sinister there, Shona thought.
"Some man's to ride her. Oh, if I were younger."
And he wheezed and laughed some more.
Shona tried to hide her repulsion, but doubted she was being very successful in the attempt. Even Te Olig, who had never seemed overly interested in sex, appeared uncomfortable as Raybert began detailing some of his sexual adventures in great detail, laughing and wheezing. He went so long down his memories that Shona half expected him to drop his pants and begin stroking himself right there in front of them.
"It wouldn't be the first time."
"She's bled," Te Olig said, after Raybert had wrapped himself into some story of an encounter so deeply that he seemed to completely lose sight of the present.
"Olin is a woman, and she will be a wife, or she will be a witch, or both. But not neither. She must learn what that means in the ways of Fearox Buer."
Shona stared at him hard, not judging, but rather trying to decipher. They didn't have to do this now. But if they didn't, then Breyth would be free to stake his claim to Aulin and consummate his marriage. If they did, and Aulin lived up to her promise, that moment would likely be put off, perhaps for a long while, as Meryn staked her own claim to the young woman. If Aulin proved to be the witch-in-waiting, the next in line for the coven, Meryn would not allow her to become thick with child any time soon.
It seemed to Shona that Te Olig preferred this second possibility.
"Might thou put the girl to her knees?"
Raybert said unexpectedly, cackling with every word. Shona felt her face screw up at the vulgarity of the old man. Some of the fire of his youth yet remained, though, and before Shona could get out a word, Raybert snapped at her.
"You do not decide things here, witch," he said, pointing a crooked finger her way. "You have spoken your words, and have been heard, which is more than you should expect. Now you must kneel to the decisions of the men, as Aulan would kneel before me if I so desired."
Shona took a moment to compose herself. She thought of Hugh, who had been her husband, who had so often spoken to her in such a manner, and usually with an accompanying punch. She didn't much miss him. She thought of Fionnla, who would never say such things, and of her sister Ilara, and envied her fortune to have been chosen by such a man as that.
"I knelt to the demands of my husband, in accordance with the ways of Fearox Buer," Shona dared to retort. "He is not here."
"He is dead,"
said one of the other venerable tribesmen. A man called Anname.
2 dozen years. You should be dead as well, for as long, in fidelity and respect."
Shona stiffened, trying not to let the words shake her. Sometimes, in Uskar culture, the wife would accept death when losing the man who had chosen her. Again, Shona thought of Ilara, who hadn't chosen such a course, but who had broken with the fall of Fionnla, and so had been helped to the Korsaleog the jeweled shore of Uskar Heaven, by the other men, who so happily had thrown her into Kresadith.
"And yet here I stand," she answered defiantly.
Shona had been in the coven when Hugh had fallen from a ledge to his death while in pursuit of a deer, and so Shona had been beyond the wicked grip of angry men.
"You, all of you, in your wisdom, tasked me with the teaching of this girl, like so many before her who have grown under my eye. And when those others neared womanhood, they were ready. I told you as much. But I tell you for the sake of all involved, including Braith too, that this one is not ready."
"Then might be that you're losing your talent," Teolik threatened. "Might that Shona's fading into her days as a crone. Might that being without a husband for so many the year has left Shona forgetful of the ways of Uskar."
Shona did not like where this rant was leading.
"Oh, but I can control a girl," she said,
but admitted for Aulan's sake and not her own.
"But not so much this girl."
"You admit failure?"
"No."
"Oh, but did you not just claim to be unable to tame her?"
said Teolig, letting the doubt hang in the air.
"What use left for Shona then?" he asked,
and that wicked smile returned.
"Might that you should be given to Kresadird after all, to serve again in your proper place as consort to Hugh in Korsaleog. Aye, as you should have joined him a score of years ago."
Shona scoffed, but was dismayed to see the other elder tribesmen nodding. And, of course, Raybert was giggling with dark amusement. A long moment of uncomfortable silence dominated the small group then. Shona turned to Meryn for some support, but the Uskar Regin wouldn't even look at her, wouldn't match her stare. Not there. Not then.
"I remember Hugh,"
Raybert exclaimed suddenly, as if just catching on to the conversation, surprising everyone.
"Been dead a long time."
He looked at Shona and seemed perplexed, pausing as if his mind was trying to catch up with the stream of memories.
"But you're still here, are you? Might that it's time we seek another teacher for this unbroken filly, so that you might go to serve Hugh?"
Shona fought hard to maintain her composure, though surely her eyes widened at so blatant a threat. She understood, of course, that such violent talk was common among the men, particularly the older ones, whose lust had long turned to impotent frustration. She knew that such talk often centered on her, especially when Teolig was part of the conversation. Of late, it seemed that the powerful man had come to profoundly hate her. Fionnla's failure and humiliation had happened on one of Teolig's earliest raids, and the vicious warrior had been one of Fionnla's harshest critics. Fionnla's death at the claws and maw of the fossa hadn't sated his anger at the man, and Shona's subsequent attempts to rehabilitate Fionnla's reputation and to protect her sister Alara certainly hadn't pleased Teolig. Shona had believed then, and still did believe, that the young warrior had lusted after Alara, who was much younger than Shona, and only a few years older than him. In fact, as far as Shona knew, she was the only woman who had ever piqued Teolig's interest. She winced at recalling that suspicion now, given the man's obviously intense interest in the fate of Aulan, who possessed her mother's unusual beauty. Perhaps Teolig was being driven by more than his hatred of her, Shona thought, and the implications of that scared her more than the thought of being cast into Kresadith. And now, hearing the venerable Raybert laying bare the threat of violence against her, staggered the woman, and reminded her just how precarious her, and by extension Aulan's, situation truly was.
"No,"
she replied to Raybert, her voice as calm, strong, and steady as she could manage.
"I have much teaching left in me." "She's a woman,"
Raybert snapped back at her.
We must learn her purpose. Are you a worthy Inyanthiach or not?
I am, she flatly replied. His use of the old title for women whose entire lives had been devoted to teaching girls in the way of Uskar had touched Shona's pride and stung her sensibilities, harking back to a time when there were many more Uskar and women were much more valued than now.
"Then make young Aulan ready," the Uskar Forfak warned, seeming frighteningly cogent then. "This very season, Aulan must walk the Crystal Caverns so that she is fully measured. We must know. The Uskar Regin must know and choose. The girl must learn what it is to be a woman."
"She'll be married at next summer solstice,"
Anna May said, and sniggered.
"Oh, but then she'll learn what it really means to be a woman."
The men all laughed. Shona did not. She stared hard at Te Olig, and got the feeling that he was laughing more because it was expected of him than because he thought it funny.
"She is willful," Shona warned them, aiming her words at the war leader, who alone might be able to turn this decision the other way.
"So is Breith," Te Olig replied coldly. "A fine warrior, strong and powerful."
The others nodded.
"Be warned, Shona. Breith will teach the girl her place if you do not," said Te Olig.
Shona caught it then, clearly so. Te Olig didn't want Breith on top of Aulan.
"And if you do not," said Raybert, "or if you cannot, then..."
He left the threat hanging there, but Shona mentally finished the thought for him. "If you cannot, then you will be cast into the mouth of God." She bowed to the elders, cast a glance at a clearly mortified Meren, and took three steps backward away from the fire, as was required of a woman leaving the presence of such men. Then she turned and strode off determinedly into the rising dawn to find her student and prepare the willful young woman for the dangerous trials ahead. Breith intercepted Shona as she crossed the encampment. She and the fierce young man had rarely spoken a word to each other, so when she saw him approaching, she felt a mix of curiosity and of fear. The young warrior had developed quite a reputation among the witches of the coven. None of it good. Few women in the tribe weren't married, and a warrior was not to betray the husband of a woman by cuckolding him. Indeed, such an act was counted among the worst offences of Uskar law. From what Shona had heard from many of her friends, the fact that they had husbands hadn't stopped the overly amorous Breith from making aggressive advances. Never had he been overt enough for the woman to get her husband involved, but enough to make the women whisper that it would not surprise them if something terrible eventually happened. The slave women had been less fortunate. Breith was well known to never shy about mounting them, or beating them. Shona had little regard for the Umas, of course, but even she had winced more than once at seeing the aftermath of Breith's nocturnal visits. The bruises, the cuts, the fearful look in the eyes. Seeing his approach now, seeing him at any time, made Shona glad of her advanced age. She had no husband whose honour would be assailed if Breith attacked her. Her protest would be but a whisper to the tribal leaders. Still, the former witch was not without recourse. She reached into a pouch on her belt, felt the tingling of her fingers as they ran over the cylindrical crystals in there, especially the one flecked with dark grey, the Thunderstone. Shona was confident that she would need no husband, no man, none of the leaders even, to ward Breith away if he attacked her. Nay, he'd get a jolt of lightning that would put him shivering on his back. And then he'd get more than that. A lot more. No doubt the tribe would admonish her, perhaps even cast her into the mouth of God.
Some powerful voices among the men obviously wanted to do that anyway, but the smoldering corpse of an arrogant debauchee